outside the box. Every day there was one less duck. Five remained, then four, and then finally three, who had the right stuff to fend off foxes and snapping turtles, and the marsh hawk who had taken to cruising the shore. These three flourished. They looked so placid, so pastoral, gliding over the pond. But the pond itself began to get even greener than before. They were perfect pets until winter came, and their delinquent tendencies emerged. Despite the little hut we made for them, a floating A-frame lodge with a wraparound porch, despite the corn we showered around them like confetti, they were discontent. They developed a fondness for dog food in the warmth of my back porch. I would come out on a January morning to find the dog bowl empty and the dog cowering outside while three snowy white ducks sat in a row on the bench, wiggling their tails in contentment. It gets cold where I live. Really cold. Duck turds were frozen into coiled mounds like half-finished clay pots solidly affixed to my porch floor. It took an ice pick to chip them away. I would shoo them, close the porch door, and lay a trail of corn kernels back up to the pond, and they would follow along in a gabbling line, but the next morning they'd be back. Winter, and a daily dose of duck splats, must freeze up the part of the brain devoted to compassion for animals, for I began to hope for their demise. Unfortunately, I didn't have the heart to dispatch them, and who among our rural friends would welcome the dubious gift of ducks in the dead of winter, even with plum sauce? I secretly contemplated spraying them with fox lure, or tying slices of roast beef to their legs, in hopes of interesting the coyotes that howled at the ridgetop. But instead, I was a good mother. I fed them, rasped my shovel over the crust on the porch floor, and waited for spring. One balmy day they trundled back up to the pond, and within a month they were gone, leaving piles of feathers like a drift of late snow on the shore. The ducks were gone, but their legacy lived on. By May, the pond was a thick soup of green algae. A pair of Canada geese had settled in to take their place and raised a brood under the willows. One afternoon, I walked up to see if the goose babies had sprouted pin feathers yet, only to hear a distressed quacking. A fuzzy brown gosling out for a swim had gotten snared in the floating masses of algae. It was squawking and flapping its wings trying to get free. While I tried to think of how to rescue it, it gave a mighty kick and popped up to the surface, where it began to walk on the algal mat. That was a moment of resolve for me. You should not be able to walk on a pond. It should be an invitation to wildlife, not a snare. The likelihood of making the pond swimmable, even for geese, seemed remote at best. But I'm an ecologist, so I was confident that I could at least improve the situation. The word ecology is derived from Greek, oikos, the word for home. I could use ecology to make a good home for goslings and girls. Like many an old farm pond, mine was the victim of eutrophication, the natural process of nutrient enrichment that comes with age. Generations of algae and lily pads and fallen leaves and autumn's apples falling into the pond build up the sediments, layering the once clean gravel at the bottom in a sheet of muck. All those nutrients fueled the growth of new plants, which fueled the growth of more new plants in an accelerating cycle. This is the way for many ponds. The bottom gradually fills in until the pond becomes a marsh, and someday maybe a meadow and then a forest. Ponds grow old, and though I will too, I like the ecological idea of aging as progressive enrichment rather than progressive loss. Sometimes the process of eutrophication is accelerated by human activities. Nutrient-rich runoff from fertilized fields or septic tanks ends up in the water, where it supports exponential growth of algae. My pond was buffered from such influences. Its source was a cold spring coming out of the hill, and a swath of trees on the uphill side formed a nitrogen-grabbing filter for runoff from the surrounding pastures. My battle was not with pollution, but with time. Making my pond swimmable would be an exercise in turning back time. That's just what I wanted, to turn back time. My daughters were growing up too fast, my time as a mother slipping away, and my promise of a swimming pond yet to be fulfilled. Being a good mother meant fixing the pond for my kids. A highly productive food chain might be good for frogs and herons, but not for swimming. The best swimming lakes are not eutrophic, but cold, clear, and oligotrophic, or poor in nutrients. I carried my small solo canoe up to the pond to serve as a floating platform for algae removal. I envisioned scooping up the algae with a long-handled rake, filling the canoe as if it were a garbage scow, emptying it on the shore, and then going for a nice swim. But only the swimming part worked out, and it wasn't nice. As I tried to skim the algae, I discovered that they hung like sheer green curtains through the water. If you reach far out of a light canoe and try to lift a heavy mat of algae at the end of a rake, physics dictates that swimming will occur. My attempts at skimming were useless. I was addressing only the symptoms of scum and not the cause. I read as much as I could about pond rehabilitation and weighed my options. To undo what time and ducks had accomplished, I needed to remove nutrients from the pond, not just skim the foam. When I waded in the shallow end of the pond, the muck squished between my toes. But beneath it, I could feel the clean gravel that was the pond's original basin. Maybe I could dredge up the muck and cart it away in buckets. But when I brought my broadest snow shovel to scoop up the mud, by the time it reached the surface, there was a brown cloud all around me and a mere handful of soil on the shovel. I stood in the water laughing out loud. Shoveling muck was like trying to catch wind in a butterfly net. Next, I used old window screens to make a sieve that we could lift up through the sediments. But the muck was far too fine, and my improvised net came up empty. This was not ordinary mud. The organic matter in the sediments occurs as tiny particles, dissolved nutrients that flocculate in specks small enough to be bite-sized snacks for zooplankton. Clearly, I was powerless to haul the nutrients out of the water. But fortunately, the plants were not. A mat of algae is really nothing more than dissolved phosphorus and nitrogen made solid through the alchemy of photosynthesis. I couldn't remove nutrients by shoveling, but once they are fixed into the bodies of plants, they can be forked out of the water with the application of biceps and bent back and carted away by the wheelbarrow full. The average phosphate molecule in a farm pond has a cycling time of less than 2 weeks from the time it is absorbed out of the water, made into living tissue, is eaten or dies, decomposes, and is recycled back to feed yet another algal strand. My plan was to interrupt this endless recycling by capturing nutrients in plants and hauling them away before they could once again be turned into algae. I could slowly, steadily, deplete the stores of nutrients circulating in the pond. I'm a botanist by trade, and so of course I needed to know who these algae were. There are probably as many kinds of algae as there are species of tree, and I would do a disservice to their lives and to my task if I didn't know who they were. You wouldn't try to restore a forest without knowing what kind of trees you were working with. So I scooped up a jar full of green slime and took it to my microscope with the top screwed tightly to contain the smell. I teased apart the slippery green wads into tiny wisps that would fit beneath my microscope. In this single tuft were long threads of cladophora, shining like satin ribbons. Wound around them were translucent strands of spirogyra, in which the chloroplasts spiral like a green staircase. The whole green field was in motion, with iridescent tumbleweeds of volvox and pulsing euglenoids stretching their way along the strands. So much life in a single drop of water. Water that previously looked like scum in a jar. Here were my partners in restoration. Progress was slow with pond restoration hours squeezed between years' worth of Girl Scout meetings, bake sales, camping trips, and a more than full-time job. All moms have treasured ways to spend the few precious hours they have to themselves, curling up with a book or sewing, but I mostly went to the water. The birds and the wind and the quiet were what I needed. This was one place where I somehow felt as if I could make things right. At school, I taught ecology, but on a Saturday afternoon, when the kids were off at a friend's, I got to do ecology. After the canoe debacle, I decided it was wiser to stand on the shore with a rake and stretch out as far as I could reach. The rake brought sticks draped in cladophora, like a comb matted with long green hair. Every stroke of the rake combed up another sheet from the bottom and added to a quickly growing mound, which I had to get out of the watershed by moving it downhill from the pond. If I left it to rot on the shore, the nutrients released in decay would return to the pond in short order. I flung the wads of algae onto a sled, my kid's little red plastic toboggan, and dragged it up the steep bank to empty it into the waiting wheelbarrow. I really didn't want to stand in the mucky ooze, so I worked cautiously from the edges in old sneakers. I could reach out and dredge up heaps of algae, but there was so much more just beyond my reach. Sneakers evolved to Wellingtons, extending my sphere of influence just enough for me to know that it was ineffective, and thus Wellingtons came to waders. But waders give you a false sense of security, and before long, I reached just a little too far and felt the icy pond rush in over their tops. Waders are darn heavy when they fill up, and I found myself anchored in the muck. A good mother does not drown. The next time, I just wore shorts. I simply gave myself up to the task. I remember the liberation of just walking right into my waist the first time, the lightness of my t-shirt floating around me, the swirl of the water against my bare skin. I finally felt at home. The tickles at my legs were just wisps of spirogyra, the nudges just curious perch. Now I could see the algal curtain stretched out before me, much more beautiful than dangling at the end of my rake. I could see the way cladophora bloomed from old sticks and watch diving beetles swim among them. I developed a new relationship with mud. Instead of trying to protect myself from it, I became oblivious to it, noticing its presence only when I would go back to the house and see strands of algae caught in my hair, or the water in the shower turning decidedly brown. I came to know the feel of the gravelly bottom below the muck, the sucking mud by the cattails, and the cold stillness where the bottom dropped away from the shallows. Transformation is not accomplished by tentative wading at the edge. One spring day, my rake came up draped with a mass of algae so heavy it bent the bamboo handle. I let it drip to lighten the load and then flipped it onto the shore. I was about to go for another load when I heard a wet smacking from the pile, the slap of a watery tail. A lump was wiggling in a frenzy below the surface of the heaped algae. I picked the threads apart, opening the weave to see what was struggling within. A plump brown body, a bullfrog tadpole as big as my thumb was caught there. Tadpoles can swim easily through a net that is suspended in the water, but when the net is drawn up by the rake, it collapses around them like a purse seine. I picked him up, squishy and cold, between thumb and forefinger, and tossed him back into the pond, where he rested, suspended for a moment in the water, and then swam off. The next rake came up in a smooth dripping sheet, studded with so many tadpoles that they looked like nuts caught in a tray of peanut brittle. I bent and untangled them. Every one. This was a problem. There was so much to rake. I could dredge the algae out, slap it into piles, and be done with it. I could work so much faster if I didn't have to stop and pick tadpoles from the tangle of every moral dilemma. I told myself that my intention was not to hurt them. I was just trying to improve the habitat, and they were the collateral damage. But my good intentions meant nothing to tadpoles if they struggled and died in a compost pile. I sighed, but I knew what I had to do. I was driven to this chore by a mothering urge to make a swimmable pond. In the process, I could hardly sacrifice another mother's children, who, after all, already have a pond to swim in. Now I was not only a pond raker, but a tadpole plucker. It was amazing what I found in the mesh of algae. Predaceous diving beetles with sharp black mandibles, small fish, dragonfly larvae. I stuck my fingers in to free a wiggle and felt a sharp pain like a bee sting. My hand flinched back with a big crayfish attached to my fingertip. A whole food web was dangling from my rake, and those were just the critters I could see, just the tip of the iceberg, the top of the food chain. Under my microscope, I had seen the web of algae teeming with invertebrates, copepods, daphnia, whirling rotifers, and creatures so much smaller, thread-like worms, globes of green algae, protozoans with cilia beating in unison. I knew they were there, but I couldn't possibly pick them out. So I bargained with myself over the chain of responsibility and tried to convince myself that their demise served a greater good. Raking a pond provides you with a lot of mental free space for philosophizing. As I raked and plucked, it challenged my conviction that all lives are valuable, protozoan or not. As a theoretical matter, I hold this to be true, but on a practical level it gets murky, the spiritual and the pragmatic bumping heads. With every rake, I knew that I was prioritizing. Short, single-cell lives were ended because I wanted a clear pond. I'm bigger, I have a rake, so I win. That's not a worldview I readily endorse. But it didn't keep me awake at night or halt my efforts. I simply acknowledged the choices I was making. The best I could do was to be respectful and not let the small lives go to waste. I plucked out whatever wee beasties I could, and the rest went into the compost pile to start the cycle again as soil. At first I hauled carts of freshly raked algae, but I soon realized that trundling hundreds of pounds of water was hard work. I learned to heap the algae on the shore and watch it dribble moisture back to the pond. In the following days, the algae bleached in the sun into light papery sheets, easily lifted into the wheelbarrow. Filamentous algae like Spirogyra and Cladophora have a nutrient content equivalent to that of high-quality forage grasses. I was hauling away the equivalent nutrient load of bales of good dairy hay. Load after load of algae domed up in the compost pile, on its way to making good black humus. The pond was literally feeding the garden, Cladophora reborn as carrots. I began to see a difference in the pond. A span of days would go by when the surface was clear, but the fuzzy green mats always returned. I began to notice other sponges for my pond's excess nutrients in addition to the algae. All along the shore, the willows reached their feathery red roots into the shallow water to troll for nitrogen and phosphorus, to pull into their root systems, to become leaves and willow withes. I came along the shore with my loppers and cut the willows, stem by swaying stem. Dragging the piles of willow branches away, I was removing storehouses of nutrients they had sucked from the pond bottom. The brush pile in the field grew taller, soon to be browsed by cottontails and redistributed far and wide as rabbit droppings. Willow responds vigorously to cutting and sends up long, straight shoots that can tower over my head in a single growing season. I left the thickets away from the water for rabbits and songbirds, but those right at the shore I cut and bundled for making baskets. The larger stems became the foundation for garden trellises for pole beans and morning glories. I also gathered mint and other herbs along the banks. As with the willows, the more I picked, the more it seemed to grow back. Everything I took moved the pond a step closer to clear. Every cup of mint tea struck a blow for nutrient removal. Cleaning the pond by cutting willows really seemed to help. I cut with renewed enthusiasm, moving in a mindless rhythm with my loppers. Snick, 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 clearing whole swaths of shoreline as willow stems fell at my feet. And then something, perhaps a movement glimpsed out of the corner of my eye, perhaps a silent plea, made me stop. In the last stem left standing was a beautiful little nest, a cup woven sweetly of juncus rushes and thread-like roots around a fork in the tree, a marvel of homemaking. I peered inside, and there were three eggs the size of lima beans lying in a circlet of pine needles. What a treasure I had nearly destroyed in my zeal to improve the habitat. Nearby, the mother, a yellow warbler, flitted in the bushes, calling an alarm. I was so quick and single-minded about what I was doing that I forgot to look. I forgot to acknowledge that creating the home that I wanted for my children jeopardized the homemaking of other mothers whose intents were no different from mine. It came to me once again that restoring a habitat, no matter how well-intentioned, produces casualties. We set ourselves up as arbiters of what is good, when often our standards of goodness are driven by narrow interests, by what we want. I piled the cut brush back up near the nest in some semblance of the protective cover I had destroyed, and sat on a rock, concealed on the other side of the pond, to see if she would come back. What did she think as she watched me come closer and closer, laying waste to the home she had carefully chosen, threatening her family? There are powerful forces of destruction loose in the world, advancing inexorably toward her children and mine. The onslaught of progress, well-intentioned to improve human habitat, threatens the nest I've chosen for my children as surely as I threatened hers. What does a good mother do? I continued to clear out the algae, let the silt settle, and it looked better. But I went back a week later to a foamy green mass. It's kind of like cleaning the kitchen. You get everything put away, wipe off the countertops, and before you know it, there are drips of peanut butter and jelly everywhere, and you have to do it all over again. Life adds up. It's eutrophic. But I could see ahead to a time when my kitchen would stay too clean. I would have an oligotrophic kitchen. Without the girls to mess it up, I would be longing for leftover cereal bowls, for a eutrophic kitchen, for signs of life. I pull my red toboggan to the other end of the pond and start to work in the shallows. Immediately, my rake gets stalled with a heavy load of weeds that I drag slowly to the surface. This mat has a different weight and texture than the slippery sheets of cladophora that I've been dredging. I lay it down on the grass for a closer look, and spread the film with my fingers until it stretches into what looks like a green fishnet stocking, a fine mesh network like a drift net suspended in the water. This is hydrodictyon. I stretch it between my fingers and it glistens, almost weightless, after the water has drained away. As orderly as a honeycomb, hydrodictyon is a geometric surprise in the seemingly random stew of a murky pond. It hangs in the water, a colony of tiny nets, all fused together. Under the microscope, the fabric of hydrodictyon is made up of tiny, six-sided polygons, a mesh of linked green cells that surround the holes of the net. It multiplies quickly because of a unique means of clonal reproduction. Inside each of the net cells, daughter cells are born. They arrange themselves into hexagons, neat replicas of the mother net. In order to disperse her young, the mother cell must disintegrate, freeing the daughter cells into the water. The floating newborn hexagons fuse with others, forging new connections and weaving a new net. I look out at the expanse of hydrodictyon visible just below the surface. I imagine the liberation of new cells, the daughters spinning off on their own. What does a good mother do when mothering time is done? As I stand in the water, my eyes brim and dropped salt tears into the fresh water at my feet. Fortunately, my daughters are not clones of their mother, nor must I disintegrate to set them free. But I wonder how the fabric is changed when the release of daughters tears a hole. Does it heal over quickly, or does the empty space remain? And how do the daughter cells make new connections? How is the fabric rewoven? Hydrodictyon is a safe place, a nursery for fish and insects, a shelter from predators, a safety net for the small beings of the pond. Hydrodictyon, Latin for the water net. What a curious thing. A fish net catches fish. A bug net catches bugs. But a water net catches nothing, save what cannot be held. Mothering is like that, a net of living threads to lovingly encircle what it cannot possibly hold, what will eventually move through it. But right then, my job was reversing succession, turning back time to make these waters swimmable for my daughters. So I wiped my eyes, and with all due respect for the lessons of Hydrodictian, I raked it up onto the shore. When my sister came to visit, her kids, raised in the dry California hills, were smitten with water. They waded after frogs and splashed with abandon while I worked at the algae. My brother-in-law called out from the shade, "Hey, who's the biggest kid here?" I can't deny it. I've never outgrown my desire to play in the mud. But isn't play the way we get limbered up for the work of the world? My sister defended my pond raking with the reminder that it was sacred play. Among our Potawatomi people, women are the keepers of water. We carry the sacred water to ceremonies and act on its behalf. Women have a natural bond with water because we are both life bearers, my sister said. We carry our babies in internal ponds, and they come forth into the world on a wave of water. It's our responsibility to safeguard the water for all our relations. Being a good mother includes the caretaking of water. On Saturday mornings, Sunday afternoons, year after year, I would go to the solitude of the pond and get to work. I tried grass carp and barley straw, and every new change provoked a new reaction. The job is never over. It simply changes from one task to the next. What I'm looking for, I suppose, is balance, and that's a moving target. Balance is not a passive resting place. It takes work. Balancing the giving and the taking, the raking out and the putting in. Skating in winter, peepers in the spring, summer sunbathing, autumn bonfires, swimmable or not, the pond became like another room in our house. I planted sweetgrass around the edge. The girls and their friends had campfires on the flat meadow of the shore, slumber parties in the tent, summer suppers on the picnic table, and long sun-washed afternoons sunbathing, rising on one elbow when the gust of a heron's wings stirred the air. I cannot count the hours I've spent there. Almost without notice, the hours stretched out to years. My dog used to bound up the hill after me and raced back and forth along the shore as I worked. As the pond grew clearer, he grew more feeble, and would always go with me to sleep in the sun and drink at the edge. We buried him nearby. The pond built my muscles, wove my baskets, mulched my garden, made my tea, and trellised my morning glories. Our lives became entwined in ways both material and spiritual. It's been a balanced exchange. I worked on the pond, and the pond worked on me, and together we made a good home. One spring Saturday, while I was raking algae, there was a rally downtown in support of the cleanup of Onondaga Lake, on whose shore our city stands. The lake is held sacred by the Onondaga Nation, the people who have fished and gathered on its shore for millennia. It was here that the great Haudenosaunee, or Iroquois, Confederacy was formed. Today, Onondaga Lake has the dubious reputation of being one of the most polluted lakes in the country. The problem at Onondaga Lake is not too much life, but too little. As I dredge up another heavy rakeful of slime, I feel also the weight of responsibility. In one short life, where does responsibility lie? I spend countless hours improving the water quality of my half-acre pond. I stand here raking algae so that my kids can swim in clear water while standing silent on the cleanup of Onondaga, where no one can swim. Being a good mother means teaching your children to care for the world, and so I've shown the girls how to grow a garden, how to prune an apple tree. The apple tree leans out over the water and makes for a shadowy arbor. In spring, a drift of pink and white blossoms and plumes of fragrance wafting down the hill, and a rain of petals on the water. For years now, I've watched her seasons, from frothy pink blossoms to gently swelling ovaries as the petals fall away, to sour green marbles of adolescent fruit, to the ripe golden apples of September. That tree has been a good mother. Most years she nurtures a full crop of apples, gathering the energy of the world into herself and passing it on. She sends her young out into the world, well-provisioned for the journey, packaged in sweetness to share with the world. My girls, too, have grown up strong and beautiful here, rooted like the willows and flying off like their wind-blown seeds. And now, after 12 years, the pond is nearly swimmable, if you don't mind the weeds that tickle your legs. My older daughter left for college long before the pond was clean. I recruited my younger daughter to help me carry buckets of pea gravel to pour ourselves a beach. Having become so intimate with muck and tadpoles, I don't mind the occasional green strand that wraps around my arm. But the beach makes a small ramp that lets me wade in and plunge into the deep, clear pool at the center without raising a cloud. On a hot day, it feels wonderful to submerge in the icy spring water and watch the pollywogs flee. Emerging with a shiver, I have to pluck bits of algae from my wet skin. The girls will take a quick dip to please me, but in truth, I've not succeeded in turning back time. It's Labor Day now, the last of summer vacation, a day to savor the mellow sunshine. This summer is my last with a child at home. Yellow apples plop into the water from an overhanging tree. I am mesmerized by the yellow apples on the dark surface of the pond, globes of light dancing and turning. The breeze off the hill sets the water in motion, in a circular current from west to east and back again. The wind is stirring the pond, so gently you wouldn't see it, but for the fruit. The apples ride the current, a procession of yellow rafts following each other along the shoreline. They move quickly from under the apple tree and follow the curve beneath the elms. As the wind carries them away, more fall from the tree, so that the whole pond surface is stenciled with moving arcs of yellow, like a procession of yellow candles against a dark night. They spiral around and around in an ever-widening gyre. Paula Gunn Allen, in her book Grandmothers of the Light, writes of the changing roles of women as they spiral through the phases of life, like the changing face of the moon. We begin our lives, she says, walking the way of the daughter. This is the time for learning, for gathering experiences in the shelter of our parents. We move next to self-reliance, when the necessary task of the age is to learn who you are in the world. The path brings us next to the way of the mother. This, Gunn relates, is a time when her spiritual knowledge and values are all called into service of her children. Life unfolds in a growing spiral, as children begin their own paths, and mothers, rich with knowledge and experience, have a new task set before them. Allen tells us that our strengths turn now to a circle wider than our own children, to the well-being of the community. The net stretches larger and larger. The circle bends round again, and grandmothers walk the way of the teacher, becoming models for younger women to follow. And in the fullness of age, Allen reminds us, our work is not yet done. The spiral widens farther and farther, so that the sphere of a wise woman is beyond herself, beyond her family, beyond the human community, embracing the planet, mothering the earth. So it is my grandchildren who will swim in this pond, and others whom the years will bring. The circle of care grows larger, and caregiving for my little pond spills over to caregiving for other waters. The outlet from my pond drains downhill to my good neighbor's pond. What I do here matters. Everybody lives downstream. My pond drains to the brook, to the creek, to a great and needful lake. The water net connects us all. I have shed tears into that flow when I thought that motherhood would end. But the pond has shown me that being a good mother doesn't end with creating a home where just my children can flourish. A good mother grows into a richly eutrophic old woman, knowing that her work doesn't end until she creates a home where all of life's beings can flourish. There are grandchildren to nurture, and frog children, nestlings, goslings, seedlings, and spores. And I still want to be a good mother. The Consolation of Water Lilies. Before I knew it, and long before the pond was ready for swimming, they were gone. My daughter Lyndon chose to leave the little pond and put her feet in the ocean at a redwood college far from home. I went to visit her that first semester, and we spent a lazy Sunday afternoon admiring the rocks of the agate beach at Patrick's Point. Walking the shore, I spotted a smooth green pebble threaded with carnelian, just like the one I'd passed by a few steps earlier. I walked back, searching the strand until I found it again. I reunited the two pebbles, letting them lie together, shining wet in the sun until the tide came back and pulled them apart, rolling their edges smoother and their bodies smaller. The whole beach was like that for me. A gallery of beautiful pebbles, divided from each other and from the shore. Lyndon's way on the beach was different. She too was rearranging, but her method was to place gray with a black basalt and pink beside a spruce green oval. Her eye was finding new pairings. Mine was searching out the old. I had known it would happen from the first time I held her. From that moment on, all her growing would be away from me. It is the fundamental unfairness of parenthood that if we do our jobs well, the deepest bond we are given will walk out the door with a wave over the shoulder. We get good training along the way. We learn to say, "Have a great time, sweetie," while we are longing to pull them back to safety. And against all the evolutionary imperatives of protecting our gene pool, we give them car keys and freedom. It's our job. And I wanted to be a good mother. I was happy for her, of course, poised at the beginning of a new adventure. But I was sad for myself, enduring the agony of missing her. My friends who had already weathered this passage counseled me to remember the parts of having a house full of children that I wouldn't miss a bit. I would be glad to retire from the worried nights when the roads are snowy, waiting for the sound of tires in the driveway exactly 1 minute before curfew, the half-done chores, and the mysteriously empty refrigerator. There were days when I'd get up in the morning, and the animals had beaten me to the kitchen. The calico cat yelled from her perch, "Feed me!" The long hair stood by his bowl silently with an accusing stare. The dog threw herself against my legs with happiness and looked expectant. "Feed me." And I did. I dropped handfuls of oatmeal and cranberries into one pot and stirred hot chocolate in another. The girls came downstairs sleepy-eyed and kneading that homework paper from last night. "Feed me," they said. And I did. I tipped the scraps into the compost bucket so when next summer's tomato seedlings say, "Feed me," I can. And when I kiss the girls goodbye at the door, the horses whicker at the fence for their bucket of grain, and the chickadees call from their empty seed tray, "Feed me, 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 feed me, me, me." The fern on the windowsill droops its fronds in silent request. When I put the key in the ignition of the car, it starts to ping, "Fill me," which I do. I listen to public radio all the way to school, and thank goodness it's not pledge week. I remember my babies at the breast, the first feeding, the long, deep suck that drew up from my innermost well, which was filled and filled again by the look that passed between us, the reciprocity of mother and child. I suppose I should welcome the freedom from all that feeding and worrying, but I'll miss it. Maybe not the laundry, But the immediacy of those looks, the presence of our reciprocal love, is hard to say goodbye to. I understood that part of my sadness at Lyndon's departure was because I didn't know who I would be when I was no longer known as Lyndon's mother. But I had a bit of a reprieve from that crisis, as I am also justly famous for being Larkin's mother. But this too would pass. Before my younger daughter Larkin left, she and I had a last campfire up at the pond and watched the stars come out. "Thank you," she whispered, "for all of this." The next morning, she had the car all packed with dorm furnishings and school supplies. The quilt that I had made her before she was born showed through one of the big plastic tubs of essentials. When everything she needed was stuffed in back, then she helped me load mine on the roof. After we'd unloaded and decorated the dorm room and went out to lunch as if nothing was happening, I knew it was time for my exit. My work was done, and hers was beginning. I saw girls dismiss their parents with a waggle of fingers, but Larkin walked me out to the dorm parking lot, where the herds of minivans were still disgorging their cargoes. Under the gaze of deliberately tearful dads and strained-looking moms, we hugged again and shed some smiley tears that we both thought had already been used up. As I opened the car door, she started to walk away and called out loudly, "Mom, if you break down in uncontrollable sobs on the highway, please pull over." The entire parking lot erupted in laughter, and then we were all released. I did not need Kleenex or the breakdown lane. After all, I wasn't going home. I could manage leaving her at college, but I didn't want to go home to an empty house. Even the horses were gone, and the old family dog had died that spring. There would be no welcoming committee. I had planned for this, with my special grief containment system strapped on top of my car. Spending every weekend at track meets or hosting slumber parties, I rarely found time to go paddling alone. Now I was going to celebrate my freedom rather than mourn my loss. You hear about those shiny red midlife crisis Corvettes? Well, mine was strapped on top of the car. I drove down the road to Labrador Pond and slipped my new red kayak into the water. Just remembering the sound of the first bow wave brings back the whole of the day. Late summer afternoon, golden sun, lapis sky between the hills that fold around the pond, red-winged blackbirds cackling in the cattails. Not a breath of wind disturbed the glassy pond. Open water sparkled ahead. But first I had to traverse the marshy edges, beds of pickerel weed and water lilies so thick they covered the water. The long petioles of the spatterdock lilies, stretching 6 feet from the mucky bottom to the surface, tangled around my paddle as if they wanted to keep me from moving forward. Pulling away the weeds that stuck to my hull, I could see inside their broken stalks. They were packed with spongy white cells filled with air, like a pith of styrofoam that botanists call aerenchyma. These air cells are unique to floating water plants and give the leaves buoyancy, like a built-in life jacket. This characteristic makes them very hard to paddle through, but they serve a larger purpose. Pond lily leaves get their light and air at the surface, but are attached at the bottom of the lake to a living rhizome as thick as your wrist and as long as your arm. The rhizome inhabits the anaerobic depths of the pond, but without oxygen it will perish. So the aerenchyma forms a convoluted chain of air-filled cells, a conduit between the surface and the depths, so that oxygen can slowly diffuse to the buried rhizome. If I pushed the leaves aside, I could see them resting below. Mired in the weeds, I rested for a bit, surrounded by water shield, fragrant water lily, rushes, wild calla, and the eccentric flowers known variously as yellow pond lily, bullhead lily, nuphar luteum, spatterdock, or brandy bottle. That last name, rarely heard, is perhaps most apt, as the yellow flowers sticking up from the dark water emit a sweet alcoholic scent. It made me wish I'd brought a bottle of wine. Once the showy brandy bottle flowers have accomplished their goal of attracting pollinators, they bend below the surface for several weeks, suddenly reclusive while their ovaries swell. When the seeds are mature, the stalks straighten again and lift up above the water the fruit, a curiously flask-shaped pod with a brightly colored lid that looks like its namesake, a miniature brandy cask about the size of a shot glass. I've never witnessed it myself, but I'm told that the seeds pop dramatically from the pond onto the surface, earning one of their other names, spatterdock. All around me, there were lilies in all stages of rising and sinking and reemerging, a waterscape of change that's hard to move through, but I bent to the task, pushing my red boat through the green. I paddled hard and strong out to the deep water, pulling against the weight of the restraining vegetation, eventually breaking free. When I had exhausted my shoulders, so they were as empty as my heart, I rested on the water, closed my eyes, and let the sadness come, adrift. Maybe a little breeze came up, maybe a hidden current, or the earth tilting on its axis to slosh the pond, but whatever the invisible hand, my little boat began to rock gently, like a cradle on the water. Held by the hills and rocked by the water, the hand of the breeze against my cheek, I gave myself over to the comfort that came, unbidden. I don't know how long I floated, but my little red boat drifted the length of the lake. Rustling whispers around my hull drew me from reverie, and the first thing I saw upon opening my eyes were polished green leaves of water lilies and spatterdock smiling up at me again, rooted in darkness and floating in light. I found myself surrounded by hearts on the water, luminous green hearts. The lilies seemed to pulse with light, green hearts beating with my own. There were young heart leaves below the water on their way up, and old leaves on the surface, some with edges tattered by a summer of wind and waves, and no doubt kayak paddles. Scientists used to think that the movement of oxygen from the surface leaves of lilies to the rhizome was merely the slow process of diffusion, an inefficient drift of molecules from a region of high concentration in the air to low concentration underwater. But new inquiries revealed a flow we could have known by intuition if we had remembered the teachings of plants. The new leaves take up oxygen into the tightly packed air spaces of their young developing tissues, whose density creates a pressure gradient. The older leaves, with looser air spaces created by the tatters and tears that open the leaf, create a low pressure region where oxygen can be released into the atmosphere. This gradient exerts a pull on the air taken in by the young leaf. Since they are connected by air-filled capillary networks, the oxygen moves by mass flow from the young leaves to the old, passing through and oxygenating the rhizome in the process. The young and the old are linked in one long breath, an inhalation that calls for a reciprocal exhalation, nourishing the common root from which they both arose. New leaf to old to new, mother to daughter. Mutuality endures. I am consoled by the lesson of lilies. I paddled more easily back to the shore, loading the kayak under the car in the fading light. I was doused with the leftover pond water draining onto my head. I smiled at the illusion of my grief containment system. There is no such thing. We spill over into the world, and the world spills over into us. The earth, that first among good mothers, gives us the gift that we cannot provide ourselves. I hadn't realized that I'd come to the lake and said, "Feed me." But my empty heart was fed. I had a good mother. She gives what we need without being asked. I wonder if she gets tired, old Mother Earth, or if she too is fed by the giving. "Thanks," I whispered, "for all of this." It was nearly dark when I got home, but my plan had included leaving the porch light on, because a dark house would have been one assault too many. I carried my life jacket into the porch and got out my house keys, before I noticed a pile of presents, all beautifully wrapped in brightly colored tissue paper, as if a piñata had burst over my door. A bottle of wine with a single glass on the doorsill. There was a going-away party on the porch, and Larkin had missed it. She's one lucky girl, I thought, showered with love. I looked through the gifts for tags or a card, but there was nothing to show who had made the late delivery. The wrapping was just tissue paper, so I hunted for a clue. I smoothed the purple paper tight on one gift to read the label underneath. It was a jar of Vicks VapoRub. A little note fell from the twisted tissue paper. Take comfort. I recognized the handwriting immediately as my cousin's, dear enough to be my sister, who lives hours away. My fairy godmother left 18 notes and presents, one for every year of mothering Larkin. A compass to find your new path. A packet of smoked salmon, because they always come home. Pens, celebrate having time to write. We are showered every day with gifts, but they're not meant for us to keep. Their life is in their movement, the inhale and the exhale of our shared breath. Our work and our joy is to pass along the gift and to trust that what we put out into the universe will always come back. Allegiance to gratitude. There was a time, not so long ago, when my morning ritual was to rise before dawn and start the oatmeal and coffee before waking the girls. Then I would get them up to feed the horses before school. That done, I would pack lunches, find lost papers, and kiss pink cheeks as the school bus chugged up the hill, all before filling bowls for the cats and dog, finding something presentable to wear, and previewing my morning lecture as I drove to school. Reflection was not a word frequently on my mind those days. But on Thursdays, I didn't have a morning class and I could linger a little, so I would walk the pasture to the top of a hill to start the day properly, with birdsong and shoes soaked in dew and the clouds still pink from sunrise over the barn, a down payment on a debt of gratitude. One Thursday, I was distracted from the robins and new leaves by a call I received from my sixth-grade daughter's teacher the night before. Apparently, my daughter had begun refusing to stand with the class for the Pledge of Allegiance. The teacher assured me she wasn't being disruptive, really, or misbehaving, but just sat quietly in her seat and wouldn't join in. After a couple of days, other students began following suit. So the teacher was calling just because I thought you'd like to know. I remember how that ritual used to begin my day, too, from kindergarten through high school. Like the tap of the conductor's baton, it gathered our attention from the hubbub of the school bus and the jostling hallway. We would be shuffling our chairs and putting lunch boxes away in the cubbies when the loudspeaker grabbed us by the collar. We stood beside our desks, facing the flag that hung on a stick at the corner of the blackboard, as ubiquitous as the smell of floor wax and school paste. Hand over heart, we recited the Pledge of Allegiance. The pledge was a puzzlement to me, as I'm sure it is to most students. I had no earthly idea what a republic even was, and was none too sure about God either. And you didn't have to be an 8-year-old Indian to know that liberty and justice for all was a questionable premise. But during school assemblies, when 300 voices all joined together, all those voices in measured cadence, from the gray-haired school nurses to the kindergartners, made me feel part of something. It was as if for a moment our minds were one. I could imagine then that if we all spoke for that elusive justice, it might be within our reach. From where I stand today, though, the idea of asking school children to pledge loyalty to a political system seems exceedingly curious, especially since we know full well that the practice of recitation will largely be abandoned in adulthood when the age of reason has presumably been attained. Apparently my daughter had reached that age, and I was not about to interfere. "Mom, I'm not going to stand there and lie," she explained, "and it's not exactly liberty if they force you to say it, is it?" She knew different morning rituals, her grandfather's pouring of coffee on the ground, and the one I carried out on the hill above our house, and that was enough for me. The sunrise ceremony is our Potawatomi way of sending gratitude into the world, to recognize all that we are given, and to offer our choicest thanks in return. Many Native peoples across the globe, despite myriad cultural differences, have this in common. We are rooted in cultures of gratitude. Our old farm is within the ancestral homelands of the Onondaga Nation, and their reserve lies a few ridges to the west of my hilltop. There, just like on my side of the ridge, school buses discharge a herd of kids who run, even after the bus monitors bark, "Walk!" But in Onondaga, the flag flying outside the entrance is purple and white, depicting the Hiawatha wampum belt, the symbol of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. With bright backpacks, too big for their little shoulders, the kids stream in through doors painted the traditional Haudenosaunee purple, under the words, "Yawen Haskano," a greeting of health and peace. Black-haired children run circles around the atrium, through sunshafts, over clan symbols etched on the slate floor. Here the school week begins and ends, not with the Pledge of Allegiance, but with the Thanksgiving Address, a river of words as old as the people themselves, known more accurately in the Onondaga language as the words that come before all else. This ancient order of protocol sets gratitude as the highest priority. The gratitude is directed straight to the ones who share their gifts with the world. All the classes stand together in the atrium, and one grade each week has responsibility for the oratory. Together, in a language older than English, they begin the recitation. It is said that the people were instructed to stand and offer these words whenever they gathered, no matter how many or how few, before anything else was done. In this ritual, their teachers remind them every day, beginning where our feet first touch the earth, we send greetings and thanks to all members of the natural world. Today it's the third grade's turn. There are only 11 of them, and they do their best to start together, giggling a little and nudging the ones who just stare at the floor. Their little faces are screwed up with concentration, and they glance at their teacher for prompts when they stumble on the words. In their own language, they say the words they've heard nearly every day of their lives. Today we have gathered, and when we look upon the faces around us, we see that the cycles of life continue. We've been given the duty to live in balance and harmony with each other and all living things. So now, let us bring our minds together as one, as we give greetings and thanks to each other as people. Now our minds are one. There is a pause, and the kids murmur their assent. We are thankful to our Mother the Earth, for she gives us everything that we need for life. She supports our feet as we walk about upon her. It gives us joy that she still continues to care for us, just as she has from the beginning of time. To our Mother, we send thanksgiving, love, and respect. Now our minds are one. The kids sit remarkably still, listening. You can tell they've been raised in the longhouse. The pledge has no place here. Onondaga is sovereign territory, surrounded on every side by the republic for which it stands, but outside the jurisdiction of the United States. Starting the day with a Thanksgiving address is a statement of identity and an exercise of sovereignty, both political and cultural, and so much more. The address is sometimes mistakenly viewed as a prayer, but the children's heads are not bowed. The elders at Onondaga teach otherwise, that the address is far more than a pledge, a prayer, or a poem alone. Two little girls step forward with arms linked and take up the words again. We give thanks to all of the waters of the world for quenching our thirst, for providing strength and nurturing life for all beings. We know its power in many forms, waterfalls and rain, mists and streams, rivers and oceans, snow and ice. We are grateful that the waters are still here and meeting their responsibility to the rest of creation. Can we agree that water is important to our lives and bring our minds together as one to send greetings and thanks to the water? Now our minds are one. I'm told that the Thanksgiving address is at heart an invocation of gratitude, but it is also a material, scientific inventory of the natural world. Another name for the oration is greetings and thanks to the natural world. And it goes forward. Each element of the ecosystem is named in its turn, along with its function. It is a lesson in native science. We turn our thoughts to all of the fish life in the water. They were instructed to cleanse and purify the water. They also give themselves to us as food. We are grateful that they continue to do their duties, and we send to the fish our greetings and our thanks. Now our minds are one. Now we turn toward the vast fields of plant life. As far as the eye can see, the plants grow, working many wonders. They sustain many life forms. With our minds gathered together, we give thanks and look forward to seeing plant life for many generations to come. Now our minds are one. When we look about us, we see that the berries are still here, providing us with delicious foods. The leader of the berries is the strawberry, the first to ripen in the spring. Can we agree that we are grateful that the berries are with us in the world and send our thanksgiving, love, and respect to the berries? Now our minds are one. I wonder if there are kids here who, like my daughter, rebel, who refuse to stand and say thank you to the earth. Seems hard to argue with gratitude for berries. With one mind, we honor and thank all the food plants we harvest from the garden, especially the three sisters who feed the people with such abundance. Since the beginning of time, the grains, vegetables, beans, and fruit have helped the people to survive. Many other living things draw strength from them as well. We gather together in our minds all the plant foods and send them a greeting and thanks. Now our minds are one. The kids take note of each addition and nod in agreement, especially for food. A little boy in a Red Hawks lacrosse shirt steps forward to speak. Now we turn to the medicine herbs of the world. From the beginning, they were instructed to take away sickness. They are always waiting and ready to heal us. We're so happy that they are still among us, those special few who remember how to use the plants for healing. With one mind, we send thanksgiving, love, and respect to the medicines and the keepers of the medicines. Now our minds are one. Standing around us, we see all the trees. The earth has many families of trees who each have their own instructions and uses. Some provide shelter and shade, others fruit and beauty and many useful gifts. The maple is the leader of the trees, to recognize its gift of sugar when the people need it most. Many peoples of the world recognize a tree as a symbol of peace and strength. With one mind, we greet and thank the tree life. Now our minds are one. The address is, by its very nature of greetings to all who sustain us, long, but it can be done in abbreviated form or in long and loving detail. At the school, it is tailored to the language skills of the children speaking it. Part of its power surely rests in the length of time it takes to send greetings and thanks to so many. The listeners reciprocate the gift of the speaker's words with their attention and by putting their minds into the place where gathered minds meet. You could be passive and just let the words and the time flow by, but each call asks for the response. Now our minds are one. You have to concentrate. You have to give yourself to the listening. It takes effort, especially in a time when we are accustomed to sound bites and immediate gratification. When the long version is done at joint meetings with non-native business or government officials, they often get a little fidgety, especially the lawyers. They want to get on with it, their eyes darting around the room, trying so hard not to look at their watches. My own students profess to cherish the opportunity to share this experience of the Thanksgiving address. And yet it never fails that one or a few comment that it goes on too long. Poor you, I sympathize. What a pity that we have so much to be thankful for. We gather our minds together to send our greetings and thanks to all the beautiful animal life of the world who walk about with us. They have many things to teach us as people. We are grateful that they continue to share their lives with us and hope that it will always be so. Let us put our minds together as one and send our thanks to the animals. Now our minds are one. Imagine raising children in a culture in which gratitude is the first priority. Frida Jacques works at the Onondaga Nation School. She is a clan mother, the school community liaison, and a generous teacher. She explains to me that the Thanksgiving address embodies the Onondaga relationship with the world. Each part of creation is thanked in turn for fulfilling its creator-given duty to the others. It reminds you every day that you have enough, she says. More than enough. Everything needed to sustain life is already here. When we do this every day, it leads us to an outlook of contentment and respect for all of creation. You can't